the European arrest warrant until tomorrow or transfers from prison. I'm going to deal solely with the job of a judge and how we need to centre some of what we've been talking about around judges. There's no PowerPoint, so you actually have to listen, sorry about that. There is within the bundle of documents a speaking note which has headlines of what I'm going to talk about. I've had two roles which have involved dealing with allegations made against extremists of terrorist activity. First, as a High Court judge in the United Kingdom, I have tried a number of alleged terrorists. They have been alleged to be members of Al-Qaeda, IS, and on one occasion, Tamil Tigers. For my last 3 years as a judge, I was the judge in charge of what's called the terrorist list. That meant that all people charged with terrorist offences in England and Wales came before me initially, and I dealt with all the early directions for trial. I allocated cases to different judges for them to try, as well as trying them myself. The point of that is that I would be considered to have more experience in dealing with terrorist cases than most judges in the United Kingdom. It may be that Ryan, in his discussion with convicted terrorists, has had some of my former clients to talk to. I am not the least bit interested in hearing what their views on me may have been, if they express them, because they probably weren't very pleasant. Anyway, feedback I can do without, now I'm no longer a judge. Since I gave that job up over a year ago, I've been vice chairman of the parole board. And amongst the people that I have dealt with and have a particular interest in dealing with are terrorists when the parole board has to decide whether or not it is safe to release them into the community. A particularly difficult job. So judges have rather been left out of this discussion so far, but they are rather important to how we deal with terrorists, I would suggest. First of all, the judge has to make a decision. Do we send a convicted terrorist to prison in the first place? If we do, for how long do we send them there? And when dealing with them from the parole board, do we let them out? Are they safe to be let out? In no cases are they easy decisions to make, to do. But first of all, something of a more general nature, which may appear obvious, and you may think, what on earth has got to do with what we're talking about? Well, I suggest it's got something to do with it. The main function of a judge is to ensure as far as possible that the guilty are convicted and the innocent are acquitted. And it's an important part of that function to ensure that the trial is fair. If the defendants are convicted, it is important that the judge passes a just and proportionate sentence. On the face of it, the conduct of the trial has little to do, one may think, with encouraging de-radicalisation. And can I make it clear that I'm using de-radicalisation in a limited sense? It is if people have the belief that they are entitled or should, as part of their beliefs, use violence to enforce their beliefs on other people, then that is the part that they need to be convinced is not a good idea. I would call that de-radicalisation, others for different reasons call that disengagement, but we're talking about difference in terms rather than different in what we're actually talking about. But if we are going to convince extremists that the path that they have taken is wrong, and ours is the right system, then whatever the extremists are alleged to have done, it is important that we ensure a fair trial. That is not always easy when the accusation is that the defendant has taken part in the causing of or planning of the deaths of many people. If we are going to claim that our system of justice is the one that should be followed, then we have to make sure that we do provide justice, however serious and hateful the allegations made against the defendants are. As one of our most senior judges, Lord Hope, said in a case involving a terrorist, the rights and fundamental freedoms that the Convention guarantees are not just for some people, they are for everyone. No one, however dangerous, however disgusting, however despicable, is excluded. Those who have no respect for the rule of law, even those who would seek to destroy it, are in the same position as everyone else. The right to a fair trial is one of the most important of the Convention's rights. So the first thing that the judiciary has to do, and it may be a challenge in terrorist cases, particularly as in the UK, where decisions are made by juries, is to ensure that the trial is fair. Not easy, because the allegations themselves raise in the fact decider feelings of disgust, which it is difficult to dissociate necessarily from the facts of the case. If a conviction after a fair trial follows, then the sentencing process does provide the judge, in theory, with an opportunity to encourage de-radicalisation and rehabilitation. Under our law in the United Kingdom, it provides that the aims of sentencing are punishment, deterrence, rehabilitation, and protection of the public. And it's quite a good idea for judges and all those who serve in the criminal justice system to bear all those factors in mind. Punishment plays a part in sentencing of terrorists. The people who we serve expect it. Deterrence, I would suggest, plays very little part, as it is very unlikely that other potential terrorists are deterred by the severity of sentences passed on others. But protection of the public plays a major, if not the major, role in the United Kingdom in the sentencing of terrorists, as both the public and politicians demand it. It is unusual for rehabilitation to play much of a part in sentencing of those convicted of terrorist offences. In reality, if you are dealing with terrorist plots that can result in loss of life, or extremist fighters who try to get into Syria to fight, and even fighters returning from Syria, it is difficult in the United Kingdom to deal with them other than with a custodial sentence, and normally a long one. That is because protection of the public is at the centre of sentencing in terrorist cases. The public expect politicians to react to human tragedies. And in the case of terrorist attacks, unsurprisingly, politicians have reacted by passing laws requiring the judges to lock terrorists up for ever longer periods as a method of protecting the public. Even today, the Sentencing Council of England and Wales has published new guidelines out for consultation as to how to sentence terrorists. And they have upped the level of sentencing, particularly in lower grade offenders. It's open for consultation. So if any of you wish to say that for lower grade offenders, rehabilitation would be more appropriate, and that's a perfectly valid argument, then I advise you to write in to the consultation. But there are some cases, even terrorist cases, where it is possible for judges to look at rehabilitation. And I will come to them in a moment, but what judges always need to remember is that the sentence which is imposed must be a fair and proportionate sentence. In the United Kingdom, because we are, as with most countries when dealing with terrorist offences, we are concerned with prevention rather than sentencing after the event, because frequently terrorists aren't there anymore in order to be sentenced for the offence. We are passing very long sentences for people who have, as we said before, done nothing, but they have threatened to do a great deal. And therefore, long sentences are appropriate where if you didn't do that, they would go out and carry out what they tried to do in the first place, that is, blow up a large number of people. And sentences need to be realistic. We cannot have outrage from the public every single time we pass a sentence on an alleged terrorist. But they must be proportionate, and if they are not proportionate, then they will increase feelings of resentment, alienation, and are likely to encourage radicalism, which we're all trying to avoid. So the opportunity in our system to impose sentences for terrorists which are aimed at rehabilitation rather than detainment are few. Where it may arise is when we are dealing with young offenders. It's are not dealing with many young terrorists. True, but it's on the increase. Because just as in dealing with gangs in the United Kingdom, if somebody wanted someone to go and shoot someone as part of a gang, they got the youngest gang member to do it. The reason? Because the youngest gang member got the shortest sentence. So the same is now happening in terrorist organisations. They are recruiting young people, very young people, and I'll deal with an example in a short while, in order to go out and do the work, try and bomb people, try and blow people up, because they think they will be dealt with more leniently. We are reluctant to pass sentences of custody on children, which is quite right that we should be. We are not as good as many other countries are at not doing it. Whether we are right or wrong is not for me to say. But clearly children are more capable of change than our adults, and those who have taken up a radical cause and involved themselves in terrorism still present us with a problem. And let me highlight this problem for you. I had to sentence a 15-year-old who, while only 14 years of age, had been involved in planning to commit serious terrorist acts involving killing people in Australia on Anzac Day. This 14-year-old was not going to carry out the actual killing in Australia. That was to be done by an 18-year-old Australian. But the 14-year-old, who was in England, was in contact via the internet with the 18-year-old. The 14-year-old, who I will call A, because his name has never been released to the public, although the press wanted it, he was concerned in planning the details of the attack with the 18-year-old one. He encouraged the 18-year-old to break into a house of a lonely elderly person and behead him or her to get some practice at killing before carrying out the attack on Anzac Day. And he was also encouraging the 18-year-old to kill himself when he carried out the attack. Lone attackers like that need some sort of encouragement and support. They need a background of people who are going to encourage them to do it. And the 14-year-old was providing that. At the time of the offence, the 14-year-old firmly believed that he was not only entitled to, but was required by his religion to kill to further his beliefs. A psychologist who worked with him after his arrest said that he'd never encountered anybody, let alone a child, with such entrenched extremist views. And it is possible to brainwash children in such a way that their views become very entrenched. How had A acquired these extremist views? Well, by accessing extremist sites on the internet. He had been picked up by extremists in Syria on the internet. He communicated with her on Twitter accounts. Every time his Twitter account was closed down because of the contents of it, he opened another. During the period of the preparation for this attack, he opened some 89 Twitter accounts. A is clever, and at the time he was planning these attacks, he was on a de-radicalisation course. He had been picked up by teachers at his school as having radical views, and they sent him on a course. He was being dealt with by experienced people on this de-radicalisation course, and they were convinced, absolutely convinced, that they had de-radicalised him. And all the time, while convincing these people he was de-radicalised, he was actually planning with his 18-year-old murderous attacks on Anzac Day. It was, and is, a terrible story. By the time of the trial, intensive work had been done with A, and it was believed that considerable progress had been made. But he was still dangerous, under our definition of dangerous, and that is that there was a significant risk that he would commit further serious offences, which in his case meant serious terrorist attacks. So at the time of sentencing, I as the judge had to balance out his age, his ability to change, the fact that in many ways it simply wasn't his fault. It was other older people who had radicalized him. But I also have to bear in mind the protection of the public. Aid rehabilitation was important. It has to be the primary duty of the sentencer to consider that. But equally, the protection of the public is important when one considers the harm that could be caused by a terrorist. In the end, the sentence that I imposed required A to remain in custody for a period of 5 years. Most of that time, he was in a special detention centre where intensive work was being carried out by him by a number of different experts. At the end of that 5 years, if he was judged to be safe, then he would be released into the community. If he was not judged to be safe, he would be kept until he was judged to be safe. I vehemently hope, and I'll hope to get feedback, that at the end of that 5 years he is deemed to be safe. Because it's not his fault what has happened, but he's a very, very dangerous young man. So, difficult decision to be made by judges where we need all of your help, and I suggest we need further work to be done. A fundamental problem for sentencing judges is the unlikelihood that they will have any really reliable risk assessment material available to them at the time of sentence. There will be evidence from a probation officer and maybe a psychologist. Our probation officers nowadays are very cautious in their assessments. There used to be the time when probation officers said, let them all out, they're actually fine. My impression now is that with certainly sex offenders and with terrorists, the impression they normally give is keep them locked up for as long as you can, but perhaps that may be unfair to probation officers, but it's certainly the impression I get. A psychologist may also give you a risk assessment, as they certainly did in the case of A. But as I said, they will be cautious as to their assessment of future risk. So for the judge, it is very difficult, if not nearly impossible, for him or her to make any reliable assessment of whether, and this is an example which comes up all the time, a returnee from Syria has returned because having seen IS at close quarters, he has now turned away from radical beliefs, wants to return to his family in the United Kingdom and lead a decent life. Or is he simply saying that as a way of getting back in the country on the instructions of IS to kill people as and when he is free to do so? How do you make that judgment? And if you are the judge and you let him out and then he goes and kills people, then it's not very good for the judge or the judicial system. Now my experience also is that terrorists are frequently cleverer than the average criminal and are often convincing even when they're not telling the truth. And this is supported by quite a lot of psychological research, I believe, certainly what I've read, but I'm not a psychologist, that they can be more deceptive than quite a lot of other people. So, if the judge gets it wrong, many, many people may die. So, for those reasons, the number of occasions on which a sentencing judge can concentrate on rehabilitation rather than containment and protection of the public when dealing with terrorists in the United Kingdom will be small. And what is required before that can happen is reliable risk assessment and a detailed plan from probation with intensive measures and real safeguards to protect the public and ensure they can remain protected if rehabilitation doesn't work. So let me now move to the parole board. As a member of the parole board sitting as a judicial member, i.e. a judge, I deal with prisoners who are serving indeterminate, that's their release when they're safe, or extended sentences because they've committed very serious offences or they've been found to be dangerous. This can include persons convicted of terrorist offences. The test we have to apply by statute is we only release them back into society. We only release them if we are satisfied that it is no longer necessary for the protection of the public that they remain contained in prison. Of course, their rehabilitation into society can never be complete until such time as they are released back into society. So it is a necessary step which has to be taken at some stage. In order to make that decision, we consider reports from those who work in the prison, often an imam who works in the prison service, who will be teaching them the true path of Islam, the Muslim religion, which does not involve going out to kill people who don't believe and have the same beliefs that you do. It will involve psychologists, members of the probation service who will supervise them on parole if they're released, and prisoners with whom they have had particular contact, and those who run courses designed for rehabilitation. It is their job to come up with proper risk assessments so that we can reach a proper decision as to the risk that the prisoner still presents. Now, the limited research that I have seen, and this is rather contradictory to something that's been said before, is first of all that special psychological tests are required for people who are terrorists, but you cannot just put them through the ordinary psychological risk assessment test. I'll be interested to hear from psychologists later whether this is right or not. And secondly, that the risk assessment tests we presently have for terrorists are not reliable. And they are not reliable because most risk assessment tests, as I understand it, are based on experience of what happens when the prisoner is released. And the reality is we haven't had sufficient terrorists to have gone through the system and been released to make that assessment, post facto assessment of risk assessment. So we don't have that statistical evidence, which is an important tool for assessing risk. And as I've said, part of these terrorists are more intelligent, I suspect, than many prisoners, and have a greater capacity to deceive those who work with them. So I badly need. And when I've asked psychologists who've given evidence of parole hearings how reliable are these tests, they say, well, they're not great. So we badly need, and this is where research is immediately needed, reliable risk assessment so that I can rely on it. Someone says to me, he is now changed and there is no significant risk of further offences. I can then safely release him. Because if I release him and he does something, that's my fault, and that's the parole board brought into dispute. Finally, we've been talking about exchange of information. Well, I don't think it works. Let me give you an example of that. With convicted terrorists in prison, the security services, the counter-terrorism police, will undoubtedly be keeping an eye on their activities. The prison will be feeding back information to them, which they will look into. Now, security services and the counter-terrorism police will not share that information with us. They have perfectly good reasons for not doing it, and that is that many of the people who sit on parole boards, who are just, I say ordinary people, but they reflect the general population for the job, they are independent, they have no security vetting, and they will be being given, if they're given the source of the information which may put lives in danger. Much of the information the security services get will come from other people in prison, it will become other people who may be supposedly part of terrorist networks, chat conversations, things like that. Now, they won't tell us that information. So at present, the security service could have information that if we release someone, they're going to go out to commit a criminal or terrorist attack, and we would not know about it. Now, we're trying to solve this problem, but it is unbelievably difficult, and I'd be interested to know if any of the rest of you solved it, because it'd be quite good to know. But let me give you an example. A terrorist is applying for parole. The people in prison say, who work with him, say he's fine. But for me, I'm not quite sure how much experience the people who work with him in prisons actually have of dealing with terrorists, because at the moment all our terrorists are spread around at different prisons. So their own experience is quite important. A security report gets to a security officer from another prisoner, which is that man who is up for parole is planning to assist someone who's going to do a terrorist attack outside. The security officer, unsurprisingly, reports it to the counter-terrorist police. We ask, before the hearing, because we've seen the security report, for details from the counter-terrorism police of their investigation, whether they found anything to support this allegation or not. Incredibly important for us in deciding whether we should release it or not. The counter-terrorism police won't tell us. We get no information. We say to the security officer, well, how reliable is this information? Completely unreliable. It comes from a prisoner who actually is now charged with murder in a prison. He's got every reason to try and give us information which we think will help him. It has no great weight at all, so we have to disregard it. Now, this is a really serious situation. How do we deal with information which, by definition, is going to be A, secret? Now, we may be able to deal with this by getting special members of the parole board who have security clearance. How do we deal with that information without telling the prisoner? Because Article 5.4 of the European Convention says it's a court hearing, you need to know the allegations that are made against you so you can deal with it. How do we do that? Well, the only way that's been devised in the United Kingdom is dealing with it by what's called a special advocate system, which I think does happen in other parts of the world, where an advocate, a cleared, DV cleared, a security cleared advocate, is instructed. He goes to see the prisoner, talks to him in general terms, but the special advocate doesn't know what the information is at that time at all. Then the special advocate is told the information that the parole board have, and from that time he or she can't talk to the prisoner. So he can't discuss with the prisoner whether this allegation is true or what his explanation for it may be. Now, and then the special advocate will argue to the parole board in the absence of the prisoner why they should put little reliance in it or whatever. Now, our courts have held that is compliant with Article 5.4 by a very narrow majority in the House of Lords. I wouldn't guarantee that it will actually happen again, but special advocate system is A, takes a long time, B, it's very expensive, and I'm not sure it actually works. How does a prisoner deal with an allegation which he doesn't even know about? But then we do need to know the information. Otherwise, we are not doing a proper risk assessment. So if any of you out there know the answer to that, I'd be really keen to know, please, because it really makes life quite difficult. So, I'm finishing now, just as you're looking at your watch. So what we need is better risk assessments, a better means of exchanging information so we get a proper view in order to carry out a proper risk assessment. And whether in 2 years' time I'm a part of you still or not, I do think we should all keep talking, because actually I never wanted to leave you in the first place, but actually it's quite a useful conversation that we can have.